You entered Donegal from Leitrim and straight to Bundoran, seaside resort of childhood memory, hipster surfers, and the butcher boy Francie Brady's bicycle jaunt. Sitting outside the cleverly named Boys and Gulls Cafe and Gallery, a walker in a high-vis vest passes at some speed.
How are you doing?
Thanks, dear.
Good to meet you.
Derry to Knock Peace Pilgrimage, it says on the back of the vest, and the man wearing it is Paul Deeney, originally from Derry.
And Paul, tell me about the walk you're on.
I just took an ocean there last week. I was in Spain last week at the Derry City match, and I didn't want to go back to work, and I knew this walk was on, and I phoned the boy that organised it, and he says, one more will make no difference. And he says, there's mass tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in Termabaca. It's a Friary in Derry. So I went to 9 o'clock mass, and I've been walking since. 36 years ago, during the Troubles, it just started off as a way of praying for peace. That's as far as I know now. I'm not the organiser. I'm just dandering along here.
Dandering along is quite a description for a walk from Derry to Knock. But tell me, Paul, as well, coming from Derry, would you have spent much time in Donegal then over the years?
Oh, I actually live in Donegal this last 20 years, but but the village I live in, this side of the road's in Donegal and that side of the road's in Derry.
I grew up in Leitrim and used to come to Donegal a bit, and I love Donegal. It's an amazing county. There's so much diversity in it.
Well, I love Derry as well, but I do love Donegal too. But the people are more or less the same people.
Donegal, Tyrconnell, drifts in like a mist. Voices flinting high and clear on the road, Errigal shining long before it's visible, the surge of the ocean resounding the pull of strand and dune strong to the feet, music and song echoing in a house that will never falter.
We stayed in the Friary in Rosnoula last night, and we're walking the Cliffany today. We're doing about 20, 25 miles a day. And me smoking like a tree. But my grandfather smoked 60 fags a day.
And lived to be?
32. You're a boy all here.
Man, great to meet you.
Well, she's there. I hit that good, right. Good.
You're listening to The County Measure. I'm Vincent Woods. We're making a journey around Ireland 100 years after independence and partition to get a measure, to get many measures of all 32 counties. We're looking at place, landscape, and the people who shape their lives within these boundaries of community and county. In this series, I'm hoping to get a fresh understanding of each county and its people as we shape a radio atlas of Ireland. Just arriving in Ballyshannon, one of the oldest towns in Ireland, and a town I always really enjoy visiting. Famously, of course, Rory Gallagher from here, Charlie McGettigan, William Allingham, town with great history. And I know there's a big kind of local regeneration campaign underway in the town, and we're going to meet a group of people here who are, I suppose, very much to the fore of that, and they have been working on making and restoring stone walls, not only here in Ballyshannon but or different parts of the county. High up in the lovely town of Ballyshannon, in the shade of St. Anne's Church of Ireland, I meet Louise Price, one of the founders of the Tyrconnell Stone Festival.
Hi. Louise, how are you doing? Vincent.
Hi, Vincent.
Lovely to meet you.
Me too.
Great.
This is
good to shake site. A hand that does lots of stonework.
Yeah.
This is a great stretch that's been restored here.
We've restored 42 metres in 2 days. For every metre of wall, there's a tonne of stone. So 42 metres, that's 42 tonne of stone. It moves through people's hands. And this is an example of what you can do with many hands, make light work.
How many hands would you have had at the height of the work?
Somewhere between 50 and 60 hands. You pick a side and you work there. It's very social. You talk, you work together, you cooperate, you have to communicate all the time. And it goes up in no time.
Is it sandstone?
Well, it's a combination of sandstone and limestone. The lighter stone, the kind of blonde stone, is sandstone from Drumkeelin and Mount Charles, were quarried there. It's beautiful stone. And then what was here already, so it was probably just gathered from the fields.
That's the other extraordinary thing about the stone walls, isn't it? The idea that people took the stones out of the ground in the first place. So they're both clearing the ground and then making these markers, these boundaries, these walls from the stone they take out of the earth.
They had to take the stone out because they couldn't get the plough through the land if they didn't remove the stone. So it serves as stock proofing as well. And anywhere you see stone walls, they've usually been taken from the field. The more walls there is towards the west of Ireland, the poorer and the more stony the ground is. So it's a marker, the number of dry stone walls is a marker of how stony the ground is.
God bless the work.
Thanks.
We brought the rain though.
The rain as well, aye.
This is Patsy McEnough, he's a stonemason.
Vincent, good to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
How do you build a stone wall?
You put one stone on top of the other. But
where do you start?
I used to say that you put two on one and one on two. That breaks up your vertical joints.
And Patsy, where did you grow up?
I grew up on a farm. But my father used to work at stone, you see.
Yeah.
And that time, like, we were, most of the people in our town land were living in thatch houses. And what happened with the material to roof it was heavy. And it put pressure on the walls. So sometimes the walls fell out. People like my father were much sought after, like.
And where was your farm? Where was the town land?
The town land was Glencoe.
This is Sean White. He's also a stonemason.
Hello, Sean. How are you doing? Yeah. Gosh, great work you're doing. How did you get into the stone?
Well, to be honest with you, I kind of fell into it by pure accident. My grandfather was a stonemason too. There was stonemasons within the family, you know. So most people in Ireland were nearly all kind of something to do with stone, you know.
But did it seem to come naturally to you when you got going?
Yes, it did. I must admit, it was like... I couldn't really explain how I was good at it, but I was good at it. So, yeah, it kind of came naturally, yeah.
I also think that in time, of course, as well, the wall becomes a habitat, you know.
Oh, of course.
Like, you have to live in there.
It's a living, breathing thing. Like, it's part of all, kind of nature will all go in between your snails, slugs, and, you know, everything else will make its way into it at some stage, you know.
When would you expect to have this finished?
I'd say another kind of 2 or 3 days at it, which would wrap it up, you know.
It's very grounding, like your contact with the stone. When you're outside here, you know, you're in a beautiful place as well. So all your stress kind of gets lifted, and at the same time, you're doing good work and lifting heavy stones, so it's nice and active as well. So you do feel good after a day's stone wall building.
Louise, did you at one point work on a wall that went back to famine times?
People who worked on the wall at Mount Charles Pier, surrounding the Marquess of Conyngham's estate, were employed there at the height of An Comhairle de Mór, 1847. And we figured out that there was about 60 people employed there. And they would have been hungry people. It's one thing for us to come here today and... with our breakfast had, but these people didn't get even paid in money. They were paid in food. They had to actually prove they were destitute first before they got the work of the wall. So an agent would come and visit their little patch, check that there was nothing in the fields, everybody was in a bad way, and then the work would be granted. So there's something very powerful about doing the same work, even on certain walls like that, lifting the same stones that they would have lifted and doing it the same way as they would have done it. People say it's a short road to the famine, and it really is when you're engaged in repairing and rebuilding stone walls that were built during that time.
Burton Port in the rain, and Saturday morning this car boot sale, which was to take place down at the harbour, but the weather has sent everyone indoors to St Columba's Community Centre, and we're going in to see if there's a bargain to be got at all. All packed with stalls and people and colour, light filled room, galvanised roof with big windows. Gosh, that's a great old radio.
How are you getting on?
We're from radio. Looking at a radio.
Right. She's all there now. I don't know if she's going or not, but
it's beautiful.
The cable and all's on the back of her, all right.
Really?
That's lovely.
Would you think of buying the radio?
Huh?
Would you think of buying the radio?
Where is it? Where? What one?
Look at that one.
Oh, Jesus.
It's a beauty. Don't know where. I didn't ask what the price was. Apparently it's all there, and the cables and everything are on. Wild Donegal photos, well. Don't see anyone here, though. How are you doing? I love these photos, they're brilliant.
Ah, thank you,
yeah.
Thank you.
Are they your own?
Yep, I'm the photographer.
Ah, good man.
Noel Newell. More of a hobby than an obsession.
Yes. And Noel, when did you start taking the photographs of Donegal wildlife?
I only started about 5 years ago. Up until then, I've been involved in wildlife all my life, but then I decided, right, I want to capture these images and share them with other people.
Beautiful. I mean, just looking at, you know, a fox, a puffin, a hare. Yeah, just, they're beautiful. So you obviously spend a lot of time outdoors.
I do. I'm retired. I got early retirement, and I moved up to this area 15 years ago.
Fantastic.
I moved from a little town called Stewartstown in County Tyrone.
Great. So you crossed over.
I crossed over and I'm here now and I'm going to stay.
Yeah, definitely.
Even though I'm still a blowing.
Hello.
Hello.
I want to see your knitting.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Bridget Fox.
Oh, Bridget, beautiful. Cardigan, this kind of cerise colour. And then this incredible pink. Oh, they're works of art. Bridget, how long have you been knitting?
Oh, since I was a child at school.
Oh, this is fantastic. It's like a rainbow of colours, yellows, pinks, reds, the pale brown, and those gorgeous little heart buttons. Well, Jeannie McNabb, the thing is, you're listening to The County Measure, and we're in Donegal. The splendour of Errigal at last. I've been watching out for it, and here it is as we come in to Gwydor and there Son Errigal. About 750 metres high, rising up. And it never fails to astonish me. There's something that... No more than Kropatrick in Mayo, this is the image of Donegal. And ahead of us, of course, as well, a power of windmills on the hillside, turning good and fast and furiously today on our way to Bunbeug and in Gwydor to meet one of the finest Seanó singers in the country.
Here I meet Dominic McGillivreeja, one of the great contemporary custodians of song, word, place, and the history of the people.
Where did the music come from? Was it deep in the family?
Yeah, well, my mother sang. She wouldn't sing in public that often, but she was a very good singer and had a very big interest in the Shannos tradition and the culture, Gaelic culture in general. She was a teacher and she taught kids songs, and she taught me songs, and that's how I got interested.
There's a lot of people, I think, are intrigued by Shannos.
Yeah, well, it's a very old tradition, and it comes from the harpers used to sing and play. The harping tradition died out 200 years ago, but the songs some of the songs remained in the tradition, and even like the songs we sing in Donegal, they're from all over Ulster. A lot of them are from East Ulster, where the big poets lived, like Padraig d'Arnhem, and people from Armagh and Cahilby MacGillivonne and Fermanagh. They were the last big poets, I suppose. But because Gaelic isn't spoken anywhere else apart from here, we held on to the songs, but they're not necessarily from Donegal.
And the ones that are then, we'd say, a song a lot of the time helps us remember history and helps us remember local events that might otherwise be lost in time. And I presume there's something of that
we had
here.
Yeah, we had our own poets as well, and the song I'm going to sing is obviously written by a local poet from the Rosses in West Donegal. It was about a tragic event that happened 200 years ago on Innisfree in one of the islands there. The song's called Buedi na Scadan, which means the herring boats. And it's about this tragedy that happened, I think about 1810 or about 200 years ago. The four lads that were drowned, they were from an island called Innisfree off Donegal, the west coast of Donegal. It was New Year's Eve when the herring shoal came in, and when the shoal comes in, you have to go out fishing, doesn't matter if it was New Year's Eve. So I think it was four of them died, and they couldn't find the body of the fourth guy, and that's mentioned in the song, and the song's from the mother's point of view. And she's asking God to let them get the other body because it's hard enough.
Far in the wind about the Ganesh free, the other tarrants and that old body. Skadanly Bollinger Fagus Cantar a lot of fear Smaho Lean Bans as a henu in Nismaslamon askor the arvethil Shehar bords nab mor lagi shantir Makan bard buad nor the gusenin as tharlamer noig woldolas more father.
The coast of Donegal is remarkable in its beauty. You can't but stand in awe of the sea and its power and think of those who work and sail it and the dangers they face. Arranmore Island is home to a remarkable group of lifeboat volunteers who are on constant standby for emergency calls. There's been a lifeboat station here since 1883 and a brand new one is about to open. Nora Flanagan meets us at the ferry terminal on the island. A short drive later, we meet Jerry Early and Shan O'Gallagher at the new and strikingly white lifeboat station.
It's big.
It is.
This is the crew room in here where the crew assemble going out in the shout and they change into their lifeboat gear. Waterproof trousers, Wellingtons, jackets, and of course a life jacket and their helmets. I have been with the Arnold Eye for 30 years. I remember my first shout was about 10:30 at night in February and went to the station, put on the gear. I sat down the back of the boat and I was there all night. We were out about 20 miles to a fisherman who fell overboard a trawler. And all I could think of was that there's an awful lot of water around here and how am I going to get back home again? Unfortunately, we never found him. Unfortunately, his body was never found. The Arnold Eye's aim is to save everyone, but that is not always possible.
We go out and yeah. Get...
if you come down to this side, yeah, you'll have a little bit less wind.
Shan Gallagher, I think you'd be one of the younger members of the crew. What happens, we say you might get a call out middle of the night. What happens from that moment?
You'll hear the phone first and then the pager will go and then you'll get a text message. So they're making sure that you get it anyway.
But
then usually when we land at the station, it's mechanic and coxswain and we board the boat and away we go. The heart definitely does race because you don't know what it is. You know, and then if somebody has entered the water or if a boat is in trouble, minutes can mean an awful lot, like, so.
And you obviously have to work really closely together as a team. I mean, it's all, you're codependent.
Absolutely. Like, everybody on the crew know each other. And trust is a very big thing, too. You have to be able to trust the people around you, the skipper, the mechanic. Your life is in them hands.
Jerry Early, we're here outside the new RNLI boathouse and looking out down the slipway where you would go out and you will be going out again, no doubt, on call-outs. How long have you been working with the Arnold Eye?
In one role or another, 43, 44 years.
Oh. I'm sure you've had tough experiences with it too.
Yeah. There's always, you know, there can be a roller coaster of emotions. You know, there's always a satisfying element when you bring a boat back or bring, you know, people back. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, and that's the unfortunate fact of it. The ones that seem to linger in my mind, not being negative about it, but the ones that don't work out well, especially when there's people you know, that's and I have to say that you know, they're very important, you know, when it doesn't work out well, is to get that person back to the family. And in a funny sort of way, I find that there's sometimes as much, if not more, gratitude for that than there is in bringing a survivor home. I was once asked the question, how many lives would I have saved in my time in the lifeboat? Which I honestly can't answer, but I can certainly tell you how many I didn't.
Yeah. You wrote a song as well then, didn't you?
I did, yeah, to commemorate a lifeboat rescue here in 1940. Seems like a long time ago, but it's still very fresh and... Yeah. It just depicts the story of men that I would have known growing up that pulled off one of the most memorable lifeboat rescues in the history of the RNLI in this country, when they went out in horrendously bad conditions and rescued 18 Dutch men off the SS Stalwijk, 25 miles from here. My father, who was 9 at the time, remembered it. He witnessed the boat come down that day and it was actually, you know, right where we're looking out is where the boat came up that night. And my father says when they did eventually come up at 10 or 11 o'clock after 16, 18 hour call out, for that rescue, they received not one but two gold medals, one from the RNLI and also one from the Queen of Holland, Queen Wilhelmina. And I suppose the really humbling thing about it is those men never spoke about it. You know, it was just an unspoken thing.
I have to say, I just admire what you do so much, you know.
When you grow up in the island, it's something that it's not expected of you, but it is. And it's something that everybody on the island are really appreciative of. It's a lovely feeling to be in a place where they're good people.
Not tonight, of any night, said the coxswain of the crew. The chances of survival on a night like this are few. December 1940, round the coast of Donegal, came a great north wind that could have been the cruelest of them all.
I'll go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go, cause I'm a lifeboat man, I am my father's son. I will go and do the best I can, I'll do what must be done. I'll go, cause I'm an island man, I am my father's son.
The neighbors watch them gather. You're listening to The County Measure.
In the shadow, the remarkable shadow of Errigal on the way into Glenveagh National Park and Dún Luatha, this bogland, heather, lake, and the view across from Kincashla to Oi Island, and then you come on through Annagry, and kind of one place more remarkable than the next. It's the most extraordinary landscape.
The planters brought exotic trees and shrubs to the gardens and big houses of Donegal. Some, however, like the lush and familiar rhododendron, brought destruction as well as beauty. In Dún Luatha, Dún Luí, at the foot of Errigal, I meet Josephine Kelly of Corja na Herigala, a community group that has come up with a way to deal with the beautiful, destructive plants.
Josephine, tell us where we are now.
We're just standing at the area called Coin or Incoin. It's probably, I think the name derives from narrowing of waters. And we're just looking up at Errigal, so you have a lovely view of Errigal. Clear now. It wasn't like that earlier on today. We had mist and rain all morning and it's all cleared now. So this place is great because not only do you have a view of Errigal, but you also have a view of just how invasive and how alien the rhododendron is. We're walking here and on both sides of the road you can see the plants. And actually, you can actually see now it's the leaves are quite lime green because that's the new shoots, the new leaves starting to come out. And it's just spread like this whole area.
It's everywhere,
Everywhere. And this area wouldn't actually get quite a lot of sunlight over the winter months. So it seems to be that it just likes that wet, damp environment. It seems to just thrive there. And what happens then, it just blocks out the light for anything that's growing under it. We believe it's quite toxic plant. Like, I'm not an ecologist, I don't come from that background, but from what we've been told, it poisons the ground below it, so nothing else can grow in it, under it, or on it. And it gradually just creeps out and it just destroys the habitat where it is in.
So it's this invasive species that destroys everything else.
Invasive alien species, what the ecologists are calling it, because it just takes over the place. So this isn't a problem just for Dún Luí, it's a problem all down along the west coast and kind of the east coast and Wicklow and that as well. So they have been trying and testing different methods down through the years, and there's a guy called Peter O'Toole who was in Killarney National Park, and what he found was the best treatment was stem injection, and that's where the bark is broken off the plant very near the bottom, a wound is created in the plant, and then you spray on a very dilute mix of herbicide. Now, nobody likes to hear the word herbicide being used in a natural environment, but in this case it seems to be the least worst possible solution. It seems to be what is working. So you have to do every single stem. So if you have a multi-stem plant, it's quite intense, quite time consuming. So what we have done now is we have recruited 6 operators, and they're actually about to start on Tuesday on the ground this week.
So obviously mapping is really important.
Mapping is really important, and we've done that. We've mapped this 2,000 hectares. So we can walk over a little bit.
So it's really the community taking action and halting what otherwise would be the forward march of the rhododendron.
Exactly, and it is a very difficult plant to eradicate. the way the glyphosate, they tell us, works is it kids the plant into thinking nothing has happened, because this seems to be a really resilient plant. If it feels it's been attacked, it shuts down and it protects itself. So if you were to go, say, and spray it with glyphosate, it knows it's been attacked. It shuts itself down and goes into nearly hibernation, waits for a little while, and then after about a year, it takes off again. Whereas what you need to do is trick it into not knowing something has happened to it. So it pulls the glyphosate down into its roots, and gradually over time, it takes about 6 months for the plant to die. And what they found is you're better leaving the plant standing for about a year or so, because the root system under the ground needs to get into the whole of the root system. Because if it's cut back before that, there's a good chance that that root then is going to take off. And if we walk over to the slipway over here, we'll see there's an area that the ESB treated a number of years ago. And what they did is they cut it back and they used little pellets, and they drilled holes into the stumps and they put little pellets in that had like a herbicide solution in that pellet. And it seems to work on one of them quite well. There were three trees cut down in total. Worked on one of them quite well. The second and the third are worse now probably than they were initially. So it's just over
so
here.
It's really hard to deal with. Really hard to deal with.
So that's why we were so impressed when we seen the projects in Mayo and in Killarney, that they had found a solution that seemed to work. So yeah, we're here now at the shore of the lower lake, Loch na Coin. We're just standing at the slipway, and just over to our left, you can see that there's three plants. So at one stage, the rhododendron was carving that whole area, and the ESB cut it back a couple of years ago. So if we go in, you can see here one of the plants that were treated.
Yeah.
And you can see the plugs in it, and you can see that it has died.
Yep.
The same thing was done in this plant here, and you can see that they have started to grow back.
Yeah, they're flourishing again. But you obviously have a really good community here, Justin.
We have. There's an excellent community. The initial community group here would have been Furbridge, Gunlow here, and that would have been made up of all local people, just ordinary people from all walks of life. And that committee is involved in organising the local festival, and the local community cleanups, applying for funding for different things. There was a heritage plan done a couple of years ago.
Gosh, you mean you've a treasure of a place, you obviously treasure it.
Yeah, and everybody who comes in here sees the wealth that's here.
Josephine, it's so nice to be here. You know, definitely have to come back.
You have to come back. I could spend a bit of day with you alone, just showing you around here and telling you about the different things that we have going on. And there's a lot of different hidden gems in Dunlough too that people don't really know about. Where there's a bit of our luck.
By night and day, I dream a while and hear a distant call. I send the merland heather in a glen in Donegal, and soon perhaps I'll sail again the wild and windy sea that leaves me far from Erin and the friends I fain would see.
Hello, we are the Freel sisters, Anna, Sheila and Claire Freel. This is a song called On Jeera. The words are a translation of a song called Crookajeery, which is a popular song in the Irish language from the Rosses in northwest Donegal. Crookajeery was originally written by our great-grandfather, John Duffy, with this translation done by his nephew Denny Duffy, an incredible poet from Anagra. The air was written by our beautiful mother, Sheila. This is On Jeera.
Of a world afar from Machesh and the heartlands of Gidor. On many an autumn evening and sunsets on the sea, a haze of gold from Tory spread to Gola Inishfree, and son to Uy and Aran Moore, I hear an exile sigh. Her last look back at Erin, and a misty last goodbye. My thoughts go back across the years since I left old Erin's shore. A slanting sun on distant hills, leaving seas before. A cuckoo called on Malin shore, the hills a purple hue, the parting sounds of summertime that broke my heart in two. 'Twas there I spent my childhood, but a wanderlust would call. A restless boy from the roses.
Donegal Town is celebrating 550 years of its history this year, and we're here really close to the original castle of Red Hugh O'Donnell, Éirua O'Donnell, just around the corner again from the diamond, that definitive iconic shape at the centre of the town and a cause of constant traffic alarm and traffic jams. There were two large coaches kind of trying to get around there this morning and causing havoc. But it's a beautiful town and there's so much history here. And a new addition for 550 years is here right beside me, close to the castle on Tyrconnell Street. And it's a wood carving done from a single tree by a Lithuanian artist based here in Donegal. Really striking piece of work and a fine addition to this year of remembrance in Donegal, the fort of the strangers.
And just outside Letterkenny, I meet the maker of this artwork in his workshop.
Hello.
And notice a striking wooden sculpture on the roof.
Not every day I see a bear on a roof in Ireland.
You might tell us how to pronounce your name.
Gintas Poderis.
Really nice to be here in your workshop outside Letterkenny. And you're leaning on a hare.
Yes.
One of your creations.
Relaxing.
Yes. Beside an owl. And we're in your workshop, which has a bear on the roof. But tell me first of all, how you came to live in Donegal.
We came actually just for 1 year for kids to learn English. So that was 2004. It's still going, 1 year.
And what did you work at first when you came here?
I was renovating the houses. And then, you know yourself, building collapsed, ended up in a forestry, cutting trees, planting trees, watching after them. So I know how to use the chainsaws.
And when did you begin to make sculptures with the chainsaw?
Probably somewhere now, maybe seven and a half years, roughly like that.
And did you know you had this gift or this skill, this ability?
No, I learn it as I go.
Okay.
I'm bad, really, with a pencil on a paper.
But you clearly have a really good eye and an ability to work these shapes, these animals, all of these creatures out of wood. I mean, most people wouldn't be able to do that. You have a gift.
Maybe, I don't know, for you to decide, you know. But people like what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And appreciate that.
Now you get lots of commissions from public bodies, from individuals. So does this keep you in pretty full-time work?
Yes, already 3 years I'm full-time of that. A lot of trees going down, you know. Dangerous after New Year, that storm showed up. What can happen? So it's a lot of work.
Where do you get your wood?
Buying from tree surgeons, most of the timber myself, what I'm getting.
You clearly love what you do.
Yes, you know, you can grab a lump of timber and make something out of that. Good. Before I was looking as a firewood, you know. It changed now.
Yeah. But Donegal is home, Letterkenny is home.
Yes, there I know more's now than back home. Yeah. Sometimes you're walking on the street, people say hello, and I don't know who's that, like example. Yeah. Because, you know, when we left 20 years ago, kids grow up now. Yeah. I don't know them.
You're listening to The County Measure, and we're in Donegal.
I'm Etna New Gallagher, and I live by the coast in West Donegal. And in my lifetime, I have heard the decline in bird numbers. And the curlew would be one of these birds. When I was younger, to hear the curlew call was commonplace. But now, it's rare. Whenever I hear the curlew's call, I just be so grateful. Crotty, ool cush clotty. Chiam tu agus clunyam tu a crotty glor wer gri. Erga dun riwa a walla sa cheer. Heliu in chunny a rash hig illan fa. Illan hija emel natra. Bogan tuliat gear yetta, eg faya roth talu, gob grass tool, eg piaku laiba, gob har rib, ainly nispeya, gob shlika, snitcha snasta, chru nagali uya. Sulis dodgera, eg spearak, eg stanu, eg bunch lan, a sul as in a grinyal, fwee the spaga. Ein stadual, regal, a mun ruin ray, fwee ha, agus fwee huan, lug tra vey. Och, is tu at him weirga, a chrotty glor wer uasail. Shall kush fariga ag inilch, shall's na slefcha ag gore, we kelch o now ad arenta, waiha le sla nu por, riesk agus shaskan, monir agus kirhan. Ein shula, shkela, actrul, jeshvela. Mas facha hen tu, is boinya tu ag yart. Agus dúru go cochinta gur tarngra an washtu gur kóra mi a don iskra farigatu. Gu joku an hui in a shian the glunfertu gur rebu na stormaha frijan cheer the vekfertu. Is chig ahru the gar ag bra the staj seal chohu foru. Not too savar na wheel. Part plubba, bulgarna, gar na kuplala, le hacked and powry is too id a lee an ara. An adil wug heave, fuam na socrata, an taffin pranya cora, shkrea na hegendala. Marin tu bio le lin na hiha a chrotti rein an darahedis mar shgia chosinta art is cavia the reim. Glor driachtul an ye clap holish. Marin the hiol sa chluis mar chorhead dohish go mari tu go jaw na nimohi tu leshan hiol mar a jimmy bonus da chliachta. Och te ere, lumpe, boriha, krachte, de jaske va, eenli na speye, orinje, kush in naye. uam hiri hasta, an ul hihul hasta, an glor kien war kuhul, melish agus ushul, onis agus jihiha, emiha, kriniha. Kjol a hjolen, gusmer na grau, a agen me, fui hau, part baha, egoin bash, an ein a wine, chiem tu, clunyum tu, a hroti glorwer ri.
Absolutely exquisite laneway, boring, near ruffle, hedges alive with colour, the colour of summer and ferns. On our way to the Donegal Donkey Sanctuary, where a remarkable man gives sanctuary to donkeys that are abandoned, homeless, in need of nurture and minding before they hopefully go off to a new home.
We meet Danny Curran in the tidy stables of Sanctuary, home to some 98 donkeys.
Hello, Danny. Vincent.
Vincent, how are you doing?
Good to meet you.
I have a Jenneton here, the very thing that you want.
Paddy Jack.
Half donkey, half horse, and as mad as a March hare. Because the bottom line is, there's a chromosome abnormality there. If you wanted to break it down properly, they're special needs animal. That's what they are,
Danny leads us from the stables into a nearby field to meet some of the other sanctuary residents.
We have a mixed bunch in here. I suppose we'll start off with the two closest to us. This is Holly and Molly. They came in from an elderly gentleman. He was going into full-time residential care, and he decided the best thing for his donkeys was to hand them over to us, and we could then look and find a new home for them. Right here beside you is Toffee and Fudge, two very elderly donkeys, and they would have a lot of issues with their feet and other different things, so they're sort of long-term care. It's going to take anything up to 2 years to sort out the feet on Toffee here, that's just walked past in front of us here. And then behind us we have Ivy. Now she has horrendous dental issues. It's probably going to take 2 years. Like, a donkey's teeth never stop growing, just the same way as a rat. When they're living in the desert, where they normally, the proper place for them to be, there's sand on everything. So the sand, as they walk through the desert, grinds down their feet. And as they eat things in the desert, the sand grinds down their teeth. In Ireland, we don't have the sand for their feet, and we definitely don't have the sand for their teeth. So we have to get an equine dentist out here. Now, if you can imagine, there's probably been over a centimetre of excess growth on her teeth. Now, some people would go ahead and get a grinder in and take that off in the one go, but could you imagine having a centimetre filed off your own teeth? Getting a good dentist is another problem, because unfortunately in a lot of countries you can do an online course, you can buy the equipment and away you go, but you can't beat somebody that's got years of experience and properly trained. Another ongoing issue is the farrier. There are so many unregistered farriers in Ireland, it is crazy. We have probably about 6 registered farriers in Donegal at the minute, but unfortunately you get a lot of young lads and they go out and they help a farrier for maybe a year, some of them even down as little as 6 weeks. They go buy the tools and then they go about through the country. Now, most of them lads know how to trim a donkey's hoof. They know how to trim a horse's hoof. But what they don't know is if you've a major problem. And when people are, as I say, doing DIY farrier work, they should be fined, and fined heavily. Imagine if you went to the chiropodist and they cut your toes off.
Danny, we'll walk up a little bit. And would you know the stories of pretty much every animal that comes in, of every donkey that comes in? And I presume they all have a different tale.
Yeah, they all have different tales, but it's the ones that you work most with you remember the most. One of the most horrific things ever I seen was two donkeys lying in the drain. They'd been left to die. They had nothing to eat, and for whatever reason, they both fell in the drain. We landed back at the sanctuary. We had two vets, three veterinary nurses here waiting for us. We battled all that night, and we saved them. And it took about 2 years to get them back on their feet and get them to where they should be.
Danny, what drew you into this world of giving sanctuary to the donkeys?
My mother. My mother is crazy about animals. I was reared in Glasgow as a kid, and instead of playing in the streets as a kid, my mother would have took us to different dog rescues, cat rescues, and that's what we spent Saturday and Sunday at. So when I got older, I just did the same thing. When I was working in England, I would have found the nearest dog rescue, cat rescue, and from sort of Manchester to Inverness, there's not a rescue that I didn't volunteer in. Now, I moved home here, and between one thing and another, I was helping with local rescues, and one day, donkeys came up on a cruelty case. They had no facilities, they weren't able to work with them. They were talking about putting them down, and I said no, and myself and another fella decided, we'll take them on, we'll find homes for them. That was 14 years ago. And it's just grew and grew and grew. The six original people that started here with us, five are still here. You know, so, like, we have a great group of people. And that's one of the reasons that we are able to keep going. Even though we're a fully functioning farm, we don't have an end product to sell. I often tell people we have the worst business plan in the world. You know, I go around the country and I pick up animals that are half dead, dying, very, very poor health. I take them in here. We throw a lot of money at them with vets. We feed them to the best. And then at the end of all that there, we give them away to new homes. So, like, we have all the headaches that a farmer has, but we have no income. We get no government grants. We get no single farm payment. We get none of that.
Two here at me right hand. And looking at Fudge, the lovely white one you're talking about, who was having a great time earlier, rolling on her back. It's one of the loveliest sights to see see a donkey,
yeah, donkey
rolling.
Donkeys come from the desert.
Descending into one of my favourite spots in Donegal, into Port New and Narn, come across from Ardra and across that beautiful, rocky, boggy territory, and then you dip down and ahead of you is the sea, the bay, and this glorious view, and the lovely beach at Narn, but only one of many extraordinary beaches in this part of Donegal. You know, Dowrus and Thrawmore, and you know, you could walk for half a day and scarcely meet anyone on some of these beaches. And it's a very, very special part of the country. Kian Wallina, this far north, and we can't go any further, not by any measure. Here on Malin Head, the most northerly point in Ireland, and astonishing to stand here and think of the people who stood in this spot and lit bonfires on the headland as a signal to the people who were leaving, emigrants sailing to North America. And we think of it all the time, the weather forecast and the weather station here and Malin to Mizzen. And notwithstanding all that human history and settlement here, the natural world here is astonishing as well. Hundreds of basking sharks believed to swim regularly in the deep waters around Malin Head. And the other thing that you're struck by coming here and being here is how isolated this spot is, and of course how weather dependent it is, and how appropriate it is that the weather station is here. And despite the isolation, obviously plenty of visitors in the Wild Atlantic Way, bringing lots of people here all the time. But for the people who live here, it must be pretty daunting in winter. You'd have to be made of tough stuff to survive winters here. This far north and west of the island of Ireland, Donegal seems almost to merge with Derry, and we're back in the old and undeniable landscapes of Inishowen and Tyrconnell. The same, only different, and there's joy in that divergence. There are signs for mica and pirate redress in all corners, a reminder of daily realities and a perception of distance from central government. But the music and beat of Donegal is unique, and it's a soundtrack for us all.